Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is episode 20, You Are Not Alone. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. Today's episode centers around a subject that tragically affects too many lives. We'll be talking about sexual abuse with four courageous survivors. Though they share a message of hope and healing, their stories are emotionally raw and still painful. Listeners should be advised that some of the material we discuss is extremely sensitive. If you or someone you know has experienced sexual abuse in any form, we want you to know that you are not alone. Speak with someone you trust, seek the help you need, and know that you are worthy of love and that you matter. All four of my guests today are unsung heroes. Two of them, Erica Alcarez and Ty Leggings, are my original Freedom Writers from Room 203. Erica is a mentor, a mother, an author, and an accidental activist. Ty is a father, an honorable leader, and a decorated veteran of the U.S. military. Our third guest, Dr. Tom Reifer, is a professor of sociology at the University of San Diego and one of our beloved Freedom Writer teachers. And our fourth guest, Yesenia Leyva, is a director of education at the Freedom Writers Foundation. In her role serving students and teachers, Yesenia dedicates her time, talent, and tenacity to sharing the Freedom Writers message with the masses. Each of these brave individuals play a crucial role in the work that we do. At our teacher institutes every year, these members of our Freedom Writers family facilitate discussions on this very topic, with diary number 62 from the Freedom Writers Diary being the catalyst for this conversation. They bear their souls so we can bear witness. Current events in the United States have made this subject particularly prominent. In October of 2017, survivors of sexual abuse came forward and started sharing their stories with the hashtag MeToo movement. Most recently, the appointment of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, despite allegations of sexual assault, has heightened our sense of urgency to bring the intimacy of our institute discussions to our listeners throughout the world. On this episode, we give our guests the opportunity to tell their stories, own their truth, and be believed. First, our four guests will be reading an excerpt from diary number 62 from the Freedom Writers Diary, written by our guest, original Freedom Writer, Erica Alcarez.
Dear Diary, today marks a turning point in my life. As soon as I walked into Ms. G's second period class, I picked up The Color Purple, a novel written by Alice Walker. I began to read, kept reading, read some more, and found myself unable to put it down. Life wasn't easy for Celie, but she knew how to survive.
My Uncle Joe was unlike any other uncle. He was always there for me when I needed a warm, sincere, loving hug. We lived in a very small apartment complex, so Uncle Joe, my younger brothers, and I all slept in the living room. Moonlight filled our tiny room, and the scent of a freshly cut Christmas tree filled my nostrils. Life couldn't have been better. Or so I thought.
What is that? Who's touching me? Whatever it was, I didn't like it. It was Uncle Joe. What was he doing to me? Whatever it was, I wanted him to stop. I opened up my mouth to tell him to stop, but the words wouldn't come. It was as if a ton of bricks had fallen on me, knocking the air from my lungs, making me unable to speak. I felt his body right next to mine, and then his breathing got stronger and stronger. He was touching me in places I didn't know could make me feel so dirty. The feeling of his sweat and his lips on my skin made me want to cry. A gigantic lump formed in my throat, and to this day, nothing makes it go away. I was only a little girl, but I knew what he was doing was wrong.
I had to think fast. What to do? What to do? I didn't want him to do any more than he already had. I wanted to cry out. I wanted the entire universe to know I was scared. That I needed to be held, that I wanted to die. But who could I run to? The only person I could talk to was hurting me.
I was so angry, I couldn't think straight. It wasn't so much that he had changed the way I felt about myself. He had destroyed the only thing I believed in. He destroyed my belief in him. My only relief was when my mom came home. Only then did I dare to take a shower, trying hard to scrub away the permanent filth. My relationship with Uncle Joe has never been the same since. Now I'm certain who Celie is. Celie is, and always has been, me.
I am Yesenia Leyva, and I am a sexual abuse survivor. Hashtag me too.
I am Erica Alcaraz, original freedom writer. I am a survivor, a mother, a sister. I am a beacon of light.
I'm Tom Reifer. My freedom writer friends call me Tompoc. And I am a survivor of physical, mental, and sexual abuse. I'm a survivor and a thriver.
My name is Ty Leggins. I am a father, a brother, a combat veteran of two foreign wars, a survivor of physical abuse, verbal abuse, and sexual abuse. I am a survivor.
I think that's where we should start. I'd like for each of you to talk about, what does it mean to be seen and to be heard as a survivor, not as a victim?
I'll start. With everything going on right now, the whole Me Too movement and Brett Kavanaugh being confirmed, it kind of put me back, knowing that I did survive what I went through. Able to speak about it, it's a form of therapy, but it still kind of discourages to see Dr. Ford's testimony. I mean, she bared her soul, bared her heart, went into detail about everything that she went through, and yet it didn't matter. They failed her. That's what I feel. And now I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, the movement, it's still moving, but I know it's going to put some fear back into folks, thinking if I come forward, and especially if there's somebody who's in a position of authority, that they would be afraid to step forward, because all we showed recently as a nation that it doesn't matter what you're saying, what your truth is. If you have power, we're just going to push it forward and stick to our agenda. And I'm always in constant fear of, is this going to happen to my kids? And what are we telling them? Like, if it does happen, you're not supposed to speak. You just keep silent. You just let that pain eat you alive. And that's what it felt like I was going through for quite some time. I didn't know how to take it. I pushed it away so far in my memory that it felt like it didn't ever happen. You never forget what happens to you, the way the air smelt, the way things felt in general. Every memory is just seared in. Personally, I was molested by my aunt at a very young age. She stumbled home drunk, and at that time there was a pull-out bed that was a part of a sofa that was in a living room, and I was sleeping out there. I can't remember why I was sleeping there, but that's where I was, and she climbed into bed with me, still inebriated, and she began to instruct me on what to do to her sexually. She ordered me, a little 5 or 6 year old at the time, to perform oral sex on her. The whole ordeal was about 45 minutes. At the end of it, she looked me in my eyes and told me that things like this are not supposed to happen, that you're my nephew, I'm your aunt, this never happened, we'll never speak of it. I didn't know what to think at that time. It's like, did she hurt me? Does she love me? Is this what's supposed to happen? Is this what family does? Is this what love is? It left me confused. And because it was never addressed, it feels like I've never healed. I've spoken to my mother and told her that I do intend on confronting her sister, but not in a mean or dispirited way. I just need to address what happened and get some kind of closure and get her to realize what she caused to happen in my life and how those memories, I don't feel, ever go away. My mother, she's afraid that if I speak about it and my family realizes who I'm speaking with, that things are gonna be even harder in the family. I was always closer to my mother's side of the family, And because they were the only family that I knew and considered family, it hurts even more that somebody who I love dearly would do something like that to me. And what hurts even more is that my mother tried to silence me on this, saying she survived it and she's okay and that I don't need to speak about it. And it wouldn't be right for me to, you know, throw them under the bus with a situation like this because, you know, it's going to ruin lives, how they're going to take it. And the whole time I'm thinking, how am I going to take this? You being my mother, raising me the way you raised me to never let my voice be silenced, and yet you're silencing me the whole time. It hurt. And I didn't know how to take it. I had to step back from the phone and kind of look at it like, is this who I'm talking to? Is this my mother? Like, this doesn't feel like love. I'm telling you what your sister did to me. And your initial reaction was, why are you telling me this? So what am I supposed to do, go beat her up? I said, no, I'm not asking you to do anything. I just need you to hear what happened. You need to know what happened to your son, to your firstborn. The more I speak about it, what I'm going through is what a lot of people in this nation are going through. You got friends, family members, coworkers telling you to be silent out of fear of how it's going to affect the other person that's involved in this. Where we need to look at how much this is affecting everyone. Words have strength, and there's strength in numbers. And there are so many men and women who've been victims, who are survivors. And the pain is still real.
Yesenia, why was it so important for you to use your voice to be heard?
I realized I started speaking about my story right around the time that Trump was running for presidency. The day he got elected, I actually stood up in front of a classroom while being an undergrad at UC Irvine, and I told my story. And I thought it was important to say it, and I felt empowered to say it, because we're a minority. And if we keep allowing people to take power over our stories, who are we? We lose not only our voice, but our identity, our history, everything that makes us who we are. I was a victim for 7 years. My two perpetrators were family members. They were cousins who lived around the corner from me. And I have explicit details of both the perpetrators and the various situations that I went through with both of them. But I can't tell you years. I can't tell you dates. I can tell you certain details, like the green bus. That's the day that it all started. He asked me to go to his father's green school bus and help him get some stuff. So we went in there, and when I was climbing up, he grabbed me from my butt and he commented on how big and juicy it was. And that was the first time he asked me to stroke him. And I remember exactly how that made me feel and how I looked up, and the sun was coming down, and I knew that it was gonna get dark, and it was already dark for me. And I remember that after we finished, we went back into my house, and my parents were eating with his parents, and they were eating pozole. I remember my mom asked me if I wanted to eat, and I just said, no, I can't. So there's details like that that don't make sense. Why do I remember that? Why do I don't remember this or that? Why do I remember this thing? And now that I'm older, I think about the fact that now I'm so much stronger, that I use my voice even when I shouldn't and when I know for a fact that it's gonna get me in trouble. And I question why I never felt like that when I was growing up. Growing up, the only taboo was sex. We don't talk about that. So when sexual abuse started, I didn't even know what it was. This was a boy I looked up to. And I saw as my older brother, as my protector. And when it all started, he would remind me of how much he loved me. So I was confused. I was confused because I knew that what he was doing was wrong. And I knew that it made me feel dirty, it made me feel disgusting. And I knew deep within me that it was wrong. So I was a victim of my own ignorance, not knowing what sex was, not knowing what sexual abuse was. And then I realized that I was attracted to him because, you know, he would talk about how he liked this and how he liked that about me. And I knew I had to do something about it. So I had to start gaining weight. When he decided he liked skinny girls, he left me alone. But then that's when my second perpetrator came in. In the same cycle, I didn't know what it was. I knew that he was my cousin, and I knew that, you know, he was around, and I knew I couldn't tell my parents because my question was, how is this going to affect my family? You know, what are the consequences? And I don't have proof. I don't have proof. So it was the same cycle.
Does anybody else want to share?
So there's a truth to, you may not always remember every detail of what someone did to you, but you remember how they made you feel. Your muscle memory, your being paralyzed. When I wrote the story, I just left it as my relationship with Uncle Joe has never been the same because there was no relationship after. When I was that little, I didn't know that you could call the police and report someone for sexual abuse. I didn't even really know that it was called sexual abuse. I just felt like he was touching me where he wasn't supposed to and doing things he wasn't supposed to. When I was growing up, my mother taught me to always tell the truth, that I could tell her anything. And I did. And that didn't mean that the whole world had to know. That didn't mean that I had to let all my friends and family know. It just meant that I could tell her and she would take care of me. And she did. She took care of it. A few years later, I find myself in room 203 at Wilson High School, and here I am writing a story. And I was very perplexed by it because I wasn't sure how people would view me. Because with all of that comes all the feelings of feeling disgusting and like that label of being that girl. Because once people know that about you, that label, you become that person. And sometimes people can't see past that. But when someone is telling their truth and others judge them as trying to get somebody in trouble, or why now? My question is, why not then? And even before that, why did it even have to happen? Yesenia, earlier you said that you have no proof. Your voice is your proof.
Tom, what I love about our circle is it's multiple ages and colors of skin and geographies and educational backgrounds, and it just shows that this atrocity could happen to anyone. So as a professor and a scholar, you have your intellectual side, but you also have this deep, passionate, emotional side. What is it like to be in this circle and become that young boy again?
Well, I thought during these last few weeks that it would be hard to be a survivor of sexual assault and or molestation like I am without feeling assaulted all over again by what's happening. I think that most survivors felt that. And the sad thing for me is that anybody who's experienced trauma knows that it's totally consistent to remember what happened but not remember the details around it, because those details are irrelevant. They don't matter. My story was that my parents were heroin addicts. I was born in Spanish Harlem. They abandoned me. I was raised in Orange County. And I ran away when I was 13 to escape constant violence in my home. I was in a group home for a while, and I just said, I don't want to go back. I don't want to be attacked. And they kicked me out at 13. I had nowhere to go. I didn't have any money. I didn't have shoes for 3 months. And I met various people. I stayed at various places, but it meant that when I either tried to get a job or I was in a house and somebody started trying to assault me or molest me, like, what was I going to do? Where was I going to go? I had nowhere to go. And actually, one thing that was very painful for me, and I think this is true of a lot of survivors, is the way in which abusers use alcohol. And that's something very common on college campuses, that unfortunately there's a subset, especially of men, who try to use alcohol to take advantage of women. This is not a not known problem. And I think that that experience of alcohol, I can't even be around vodka to this day. I just can't. And to have gone through that experience, I feel too, especially as a man, that it's important for men to speak out, that one, it's not okay for men to do this to women or anybody, and that men also are survivors, and it's our obligation to give our love and sympathy for people who've gone through this experience, and equally as important, to make sure it never happens again, to tell people who are survivors that we love them and that we care about them and that we respect them and that we cherish them and we're sorry about what happened and we're going to make it safe for them to tell their stories.
To have gone from being homeless and helpless to being a scholar and to get 3 degrees and to be a university professor, an award-winning professor. Does the trauma of your childhood ever leave you? Do you ever feel that you can forget that?
No, it's who I am and it's why I do what I do. And as horrible as what happened to me was, the gift is that I can connect with other survivors, other people who've been through that. And I have students that have been abused. I meet many people in the world who've gone through suffering. And the one redemptive factor is that my experience allows me to connect with them. And we have to have that connection and empathy to make the world a better place. And that starts off with treating people with dignity and respect, and especially when it's young people and children. You know, adults or older people have to respect that. And we as a society and world, we need to create a space so that people can tell their stories and we can take action to make the world safe for them and for the young people in the world.
There's a common theme with all four of you, and that is most of you had familial relationships with your perpetrators, or in Tom's case, people treated you like family to win your approval and your favor. So what is that like, knowing that all of you were manipulated and were taught not to tell and were threatened and are still threatened by family members that you're going to destroy the fabric of reality that's supposed to be one way and is in actuality a different way?
But the way I'm looking at it is my silence equals complicity. So I have to speak about it. Speaking at the foundation on my story, it helped me therapeutically. And the more that I was involved in groups that focused on that theme, more memories started coming back. Hearing my mother say that she didn't want me to speak about it because she was worried about the family, and how she stated, well, look at me, it happened to me and I'm doing good. And I see the way she's living right now. No, you're not doing good. And I know it's going to cause a big rift, but like I said before, my silence is complicity, and I can't be complicit in things of this nature. Her reaction is, oh, it's okay, we'll just pray about it. She wanted to pray what happened away. That was it. It's like it got swept under the rug. Closed chapter. It never happened. And it's hurtful. Like, it never happened to me, so it's good. Because I never spoke on it, so is this what we're telling our mothers and our daughters and our sisters, everybody who's a victim? Is that what we're saying to them right now? That it's okay that it happened to you, just don't speak about it and it'll be okay? I mean, that's not fixing anything. And I think it's going to make the issue worse.
I think that would have saved me if we understood that people need help, you know, and that there's things that happen in life that affect, that traumatize, that scar someone. I hadn't talked to my family about what happened to me. And last year, after my first institute, I was able to talk with my mother. And even though my heart broke at seeing the way her heart broke, there being able to talk about it more with my father, I haven't explicitly said what has happened. He knows that I suffered a lot of abuse, not only sexual, but physical and emotional. I've talked about that. And we're stronger for it. I've talked to my siblings because, again, boys can also be victims. So I've talked to them about what has happened to me, not to scare them and not to make them go after my perpetrators, but to make them understand how easy it is and how common it is for people to be victimized of any type of sexual assault. How many do we hear about in the news? How many report? And then how many of those actually go to court? You know, it's truly astonishing. And this is why we have to stand up. And this is why we have to voice our stories. Because if we don't, then it's going to continue. History is only going to repeat itself. It's going to be a cycle of history repeating itself.
Erica, I want to honor the fact that you were able to speak up and stand up. And I want to believe that because you did, in your family circle, you were able to stop it for your younger sisters and nieces. Do you think that you were able to break a cycle?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. One of the things that I'm not sure how many people grasp, and it's something that I struggled with, when you are a perpetrator of sexual abuse, no matter what level, whether it's molestation to full-on rape, it's never a one-time thing. There is a cycle within them. When I learned that in therapy, I broke all over again because I thought, no, well, I told, and so he wasn't going to do it to anybody else. And again, it goes back to me. I didn't know you could call the police. But then he was no longer in my home. I broke the cycle in my home. He has subsequently married, and he has two boys. His son, his oldest son, reached out to me on Facebook. And I would see the friend request, and I couldn't do it. And I kept ignoring it. Finally, I accepted the friend request. His son and I are closer than some of my siblings and I are. When we first started talking, he asked me point blank, "Did my father do something to you?" And I said, "Yes." And I told him what happened. And I asked him, "Has he done anything to you?" He said, "No," which I was very happy to hear. And then I'd also want us to touch on the different degrees of abuse, because with Dr. Ford, I don't know if you guys remember hearing about, some people were saying, well, she didn't get raped, so therefore it's not that serious. So I struggle with that because I wrote the story and it only happened to me one time. But that doesn't make it any worse than Yesenia having to deal with it for 7 years, or Tom having to deal with it when, you know, he was a teenage boy, or Ty with his aunt that made him feel like somehow it was your fault, I suppose, to some degree. You know, I always talk about everybody's hell is different, but everybody matters. Your voice matters.
You know, there's a famous torture survivors tortured in the Holocaust, Jean Amery, and he talks about torture just destroying your faith in the world, destroying your trust in the world. And I didn't mention it before, and you're talking about the experience of, you know, feeling manipulated and also people telling their stories. Well, even before I ran away, I was molested by a relative who was also under 18, but I didn't realize it was molestation, and I didn't tell anybody about it for 40 years. Even when this person, when they were older, told me they'd done it to other people, I didn't believe them. And the only reason I ever talked about it is that I was in counseling, and I finally brought it up because I thought it somehow affected what happened to me when I ran away. Because I'd heard people saying about, you know, playing doctor, and that's not what it was, but I always just passed it off because I was getting attacked in my house every day. I couldn't afford to not attach to people I thought were protecting me. So I didn't tell anybody about it because you don't want to believe that people that are close to you that you're looking for protection are going to do anything to hurt you. And if you're really young, you don't really know anything. Like, how would you know? Like, somebody says, do this thing. Like, I don't know. There were some family members, I would do anything they said because, you know, I was afraid. And also, I've been around family members who I and they were attacked every day, and they blocked it from their memory for years. Because if you have to live in that situation, you have to survive. You can't think about it all the time. So you become two different people. I only started talking about this because I had a friend who was sexually assaulted and molested, and they asked me to come to a sexual assault awareness night. So I said yes. And I hadn't realized that was the first time both of us had talked about what happened. I never, ever thought I would do that because I thought, if anybody finds out what happens to me, you know, they'll never talk to me. I'm a bad person. And I think that one of the things that motivates me is that I want other survivors to know that you are not alone, that we love you and you're with you and you matter. And even though people did terrible things to you, it doesn't say anything about you. You're innocent and pure. It says something about them, not about you. So even if you feel dirty, like I think, you know, I did, it's hard for me to remember what happened and not feel bad and feel dirty.
Knowing all of you, I've seen you at your most vulnerable, when you get the pit in your stomach, when you're anxious. Some of you have felt dirty. Some of you are paralyzed with fear. Can you explain the physicality all these years later? I'd like our listeners to understand that even 20, 30, 40 years later, it is still prevalent.
I personally have tried to commit suicide twice in my life. And for many years, was a cutter. And it's all because I couldn't measure. It was intangible to me. Nothing was happening to me bad in my life. I was fine. I had a job, I was going to school, I was healthy, I had a roof over my head, I was fine. And I couldn't, it wasn't tangible, so the only thing that would help was to hurt myself, because then it was like my body purged it. It made it visible for me. It's not that we sit here and think about it constantly. It's just part of what we were made to become. And with the whole Me Too thing, I hate it when people are like, oh, not another one. Like, the way that people get angry when another person, another victim, uses their voice to come forward, it's mind-boggling to me that people get angry about that. What you should be angry about is the fact that it happened in the first place. There's a poem that actually my good friend Tom referred me to when I was feeling very down, called Wild Geese. Author is
Mary Oliver. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about your despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers.
Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things.
I carry physical scars from just scrubbing so hard to try to get myself to feel clean. And I carry emotional scars. And even though I might cry and I might need a minute to cool down, to get myself together, I am not broken. And I will not break. I was a victim. I am now a survivor, and I'm sitting in a room with survivors. And even though this happened to all of us, I have to believe that it happened to us for a reason. And though I don't wish it upon anyone, those who have gone through it and have survived are so much stronger for it and can give voice and can give reason to so many others who have been in their shoes. So I applaud every single one of you, and I am so honored to sit down in a room full of love, compassion, and heroes. And I say heroes because even though it was Erica's story who made me realize that I too could have a voice, it is all of you that have empowered me to fight my fear of the consequences and speak my story, because this did happen to me and it's happened to so many others, and we need to face it. We need to face these realities. We need to face these stories, because it could be our brother, our sister, our mother, and our child. It could be the person who we love, the person living next to us. Each one of us has a name, and each one of us has a story. And I want us to empower each other to just get to know each other. Because when you have a face, you have a name, you have a story, it's so much harder to ignore what has happened.
Erica, when you've been able to write your story in a book that has been read by millions and translated into multiple languages, and you yourself have met teachers from dozens of countries, are you shocked and surprised that these women and men that you've met that are educators from multiple countries have your same story? So it's not just an American story, it's not just a female story, but what is it like for you every time that you've met somebody?
Every time I meet anyone, not just teachers, anyone, any victim and survivor, my heart breaks a little. When I wrote it, I really didn't think this was something that happened to everyone, so there was a bit of shame there. And I just feel like I'm just a girl who wrote a story one day about something that happened to her one time, and it changed a thing or two. Well, I changed that line now to it's changed the world. It might not have fixed the issue, but they're not alone. I see you. For a long time, I hid behind the number 62. And I didn't want to put my face to the story. And now, I'm not ashamed of it. I put my face to it. I own it. It's my story. It's all of our stories. It's all of us.
As we've done in all of our previous podcast, we end with a call to action. So I want you to just take a moment to think about what you would want to leave our listeners, either to a survivor or to someone who needs to have compassion and love.
Well, for me, it's just really basic. In this room right now, I just feel an incredible amount of love, and that's what I always feel with the Freedom Riders. And it's something I've needed so much. The most important thing is to love one another and take responsibility for one another. Everybody matters. Everybody matters. We ought to measure our society and our world by what we do for the least among us, the most vulnerable, the most needy, because we recognize that our destiny is bound up with our sisters and brothers. And I think that we need to be more open about how deeply this affects all of us and how important it is for all of us to speak up to make sure that we tell our stories so it doesn't happen again to other people, and so that those people who are survivors feel safe, feel accepted, feel honored, not humiliated, not disregarded. As my friend says, not problems to be solved, but brothers and sisters to be loved. Unconditional love, Tupac said, that's what we all need.
For me, what I would say to any type of survivor is you have a name, you have a story, and it matters. But it is only up to you when you say it and how you say it. Your truth is yours. You own it, and you share it to the world whenever you feel ready for it. And to those survivors who might be sitting down silently because they haven't found their power, I'm with you wherever you are. And I walked this journey proudly with you. I was silent for years. But my voice is now with you. And as cheesy as it sounds, knowledge is power. Truth heals. Lies destroy. As a parent, your job is not only to protect, but to be honest with your children. Teach them, guide them. I have been a spokesperson for my family to make them aware that things can happen, but that there's people that they can reach out to, that there's power behind their story. Power behind the truth, and that there's unity. I think that when we all speak our truths, we become that much more united. I now consider my mom my best friend, and for the longest, I couldn't even look at her. I was so mad and resentful, but I had to realize I wasn't speaking my truth either. I wasn't saying what was happening to me. And so, if I would have known that what was happening to me was completely wrong, maybe I would have spoken my truth. And maybe I wouldn't have been victimized for 7 years. Maybe I would have been victimized once. Or maybe not even that. Protect your children and teach them.
I'd say to all the survivors that are listening, never let public perception set a false narrative for your truth. If you are a victim and a survivor, speak your truth, be it to a family member, friend, or even to the person who caused the harm in your life. Don't fear the consequences or how the cards will fall when they do fall. Stay strong and know that there's strength in numbers. Know that a lot have been through this, and together we're strong. And if we have the strength to speak the truths, that other people will have the strength to speak as well. And the more people speak about it, the more society as a whole is forced to see that this is true, it's real, it affects people, and it's something that everybody needs to educate themselves on so we can all come together and find a way to heal and get past stuff like this. One thing that I notice about society as a whole right now is that it seems like we're people suffering from an infliction of ADD. It's like we temporarily have these movements where everybody gets involved and does a hashtag, but then the news cycle changes, something else drastic happens, and we just have amnesia in regards to all these things that have happened. There's been warning signs, constant warning signs about the direction we're going as a nation, and it's on the world stage. Everybody sees this, but yet we just look the other way. We're just gonna, you know, ignore it. We'll sympathize with the movement temporarily and then go back to watching TV and looking at the newest thing on the news. I have no idea which direction we're going in, but I know that we have the power to change things. We need to unify. Love is what's needed. Love is what will help us. Love is what will prevail in the end.
Erica, I want to give you the opportunity to have the last word on this subject, because after all, your diary entry is what started this all. What is your call to action? And would you do us all the honor of reading the last few lines of your story?
I would want everyone to know, any type of abuse you're going through, that it is not your fault. No matter what you look like, no matter where you are, no matter what you're wearing, it is not your fault. It is okay to break. It is okay to fall. It is okay to cry. You are not alone. If my mother had not drilled into my head that it was okay to tell her anything and everything, no matter how good, no matter how bad, I don't know that I would have had the courage to write the story, much less tell her when it happened. If you want your child or your student to talk to you and trust you, you have to talk to them and trust them. You can't shelter them. You can't protect them from everything, but the best way to be there for them is to open those lines of communication. Don't be ashamed to tell them what's happened to you. They're gonna grow up. They're gonna get to know the world all on their own, the good, the bad, the ugly. If you share your story with them, they'll share their stories with you, good and bad. Celie was violated, tormented, humiliated, degraded. Yet through it all, she remained innocent. Out of all this horror, Celie was given courage. Courage to ask for more, to laugh, to love, and finally, to live. Now I'm certain who Celie is. Celie is, and always has been, me. And with this in mind, I will survive.
In honor of their truth, you are not alone. That concludes our show this week, a candid and sensitive discussion on a very difficult subject. My personal invitation to each of you listeners is to please listen, please share, please believe. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier, with our associate producer, Clay Amontorp, and production assistance by Rob Falk. Our call to action today is this: may we treat others with dignity and respect. May we make it safe for people to share their stories. And as our circle of courageous survivors embodies, may we too become beacons of light. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.